From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last night during the State of the Union address when President Donald Trump welcomed Juan Guaido of Venezuela to the chamber. Trump described Guaido as the true and legitimate leader of Venezuela, which sparked applause from most members of both political parties in this country, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Venezuela is in crisis, with Nicolas Maduro clinging to power after Guaido attempted to oust him a year ago. Maduro was the successor to Hugo Chavez, who died in 2013. Chavez, of course, instituted socialist reforms that reshaped Venezuelan society. The collapse of Venezuela, in many ways, has complicated and heavily debated roots. This week, the Rochester Committee on Latin America is focused on Venezuela and what lessons we can learn with questions about where the country goes next, and can there eventually be truly free and fair elections. Our guest this hour from ROCLA, that's the Rochester Committee on Latin America, Vic Vinci is here. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Don Kingsbury. Donald is a lecturer in political science and Latin American studies and interim director of the Monk One program at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto on the other side of the lake. Nice for you to join us here. Thank you for being here, Don.
Thank you for inviting me.
And with us in studio is Noelle Evans, who is my colleague here. She's a reporter and producer for WXXI. She not only has sort of a history of journalistic work in countries around the world, but certainly in that part of the world, and some personal connections as well. So I asked you to come in here not only because you're a wonderful resource for us here, but I think it's valuable to have your lens as a journalist and also the personal side, and I'll kind of give you the floor to describe however you like.
thank you, Evan. I'm really grateful to be here. In terms of the personal side, just to clarify, I had been working in Ecuador last year, and had ended up joining an Ultimate Frisbee team, and everybody was from Venezuela, and they became my family, quite literally. I'm now married.
Married to a Venezuelan.
Yes.
Yes. And I know with deep concern about the humanitarian crisis there.
Yes.
So a lot to discuss, and I think in a moment we can listen to some of the what happened at the State of the Union last night. But we were going to hear from a BBC correspondent in Venezuela, Guillermo Olmo, who is no longer able to join us this hour because he is covering President Trump's meeting with Juan Guaido, which is happening this afternoon. Let's listen to President Trump at the State of the Union last night.
This is leading a 59-nation diplomatic coalition against the socialist dictator of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. Maduro is an illegitimate ruler, a tyrant who brutalizes his people, but Maduro's grip on tyranny will be smashed and broken. Here this evening is a very brave man who carries with him the hopes, dreams, and aspirations of all Venezuelans. Joining us in the gallery is the true and legitimate president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. Mr. President, please take this message back to your family.
That's from the State of the Union last night. Don, what do you make of that moment?
well, it's striking, of course. I think the major thing to take away from it, from somebody who works on, works in, has ties to Venezuela, is it really illustrates the willingness of the Venezuelan opposition to turn itself into a toy or a puppet for Donald Trump's reelection campaign. This really betrays the fundamentally disorganized nature of the Venezuelan opposition, their desperation, willingness to share a stage with a person who's not well-liked in Venezuela or Latin America, Donald Trump, members of his administration, particularly those in charge of the Venezuelan file, are considered war criminals, and rightfully so. I'm talking people like Elliot Abrams throughout Latin America for their policies during the Cold War. But at the same time, and I imagine this is what the very smart people surrounding Guaido are thinking of right now, is that the calculus is off. There's the sort of political rules of the game that one might assume when doing the diplomatic and geostrategic dance that has to do with the United States and Latin America shifts because the Trump administration is fundamentally unpredictable. You know, a month ago, we would have said it would make no sense for the United States to assassinate the leader of the Quds Force on foreign soil, to assassinate Qasem Soleimani. And yet they did so. today we say that, you know, an invasion or a military intervention in Venezuela, which has been called for by Juan Guaido, which has been called for by other prominent figures of the Venezuelan opposition, a move, by the way, which is profoundly unpopular in Venezuela itself. You know, we would normally think this would be impossible because that's a royal road to a civil war in Venezuela. But again, with the Trump administration, we just don't know.
There's an event with Don Kingsbury that Rockla is sponsoring. I'm going to ask Vic to tell you a little bit about that, and then we're going to kind of work through some of the dynamics on the ground in Venezuela, the humanitarian crisis, and what some of the options, or at least the recent history of American intervention, has looked like. What's coming up here, Vic?
Our event is this evening at the Downtown United Presbyterian Church at 7 o'clock this evening. The facility is equipped for handicapped, and there's parking directly across the street. It's part of a series we're doing on Venezuela, and Donald Kingsbury has graciously accepted our invitation to attend tonight. That's basically what we have on schedule. This is a part of a whole series of talks that we have semi-monthly, at least, about various affairs concerning Latin America.
And again, tonight, what time?
7 p.m.
7 p.m., if you'd like to attend here. Donna, I want to ask you about what, in my very, very much lay and self-awarely, mostly ignorant understanding of Venezuela is. Sometimes when I see reporting and public discourse about Guaido, for example, it sort of rings as if there is a menu of two total options, which is to support Guaido or to support the international support of Guaido and recognition of his leadership, or to sort of cheer on a return to leadership and legitimacy for Maduro. And I'm curious to know if you think that that bifurcation is too neat, and that there maybe are other options.
I think that's a really important question. I think that is precisely the narrative that both Guaido and Maduro are trying to produce and cultivate, really, as the only two options for Venezuela. One of the things that I argue, and you know, I'm not alone in this, is that any resolution to the multiple crises, very real crises that Venezuela and Venezuelans are facing today, the political divisions, the social costs of, you know, shortages in basic foodstuffs, medicine, the refugee crisis, the ecological crises that Venezuela is facing today that have to do with mining, with oil extraction, with climate change. Any sort of resolution to these problems has to come from the bottom up. Right now you have a situation in which Maduro wants to cling to power by any means necessary, and he's done so, and a situation in which Guaido wants to take power by any means necessary, and he's doing so, up to and including appearing shoulder to shoulder with Iván Duque of Colombia and Mike Pompeo of the United States and making up fabricated claims that Venezuela is harboring Hezbollah. Right, that Venezuela is a launching pad for terrorist attacks on the United States. Again, inviting the worst elements of the Trump White House to continue their pattern of intervention elsewhere in the world in Venezuela, a situation that will only make matters worse. In my analysis, in my opinion, there's two really bad options on the table for Venezuela, both of which preclude and assume that it's impossible that a sort of bottom-up response to the crisis, the sort of constituent energies that made the early 2000s such a profoundly democratic, creative, and inclusive, egalitarian period in Venezuelan history, that's the road forward. And that's the road that both Maduro and Guaido are turning their back from right now.
As someone who has not only covered the region, but also has these personal concerns, what worries you most about this notion of sort of these two competing interests and what the reality is right now and what the reality might be for the Venezuelan people?
First of all, I feel as though I'm not somebody who can speak on behalf of Venezuelans. I am not from Venezuela. So I feel as though what I've done is I've reached out to folks that I know who have been through this and ask them, you know, what their take is. There are mixed views on Guaido. There are some people who say that, you know, anybody but Maduro. There are folks that say neither is an option. And there are folks that are just so desperate for change. So I don't really know how to answer your question, Evan.
But the desperation, I mean, one of the things that you've pressed me to understand is just the rate at which Venezuelans are leaving their country in desperate times.
Yes, and the other issue is how countries are receiving Venezuelans. So you have issues, for instance, in Ecuador, where I was. There was an incident around this time last year in Ibarra, and there it was a femicide. A man killed his partner, and she was pregnant, and she was Ecuadorian, and he was Venezuelan. And the president of Ecuador, when he spoke to this, he did not say, we need to address the issue of femicides. He said, we can't have these Venezuelans coming here, taking our women, killing our women, and, you know, making, you know, the situation more unstable here. You've seen that in Peru and other places too. Borders are have been closing to Venezuelans. It has created an even more dire situation for people.
I'm going to turn back to Don's work, particularly on, I think, what is sometimes a bad faith dissection of the last two decades of policy change. And we're going to get to that in just a second here. But when it comes to, again, your relationships, not speaking for all Venezuelans, but not just your husband, but friends that you have and his own concerns there, what do you think we maybe sometimes gloss over when it comes to authoritarianism, a regime that, as Don mentions, is desperate to cling to power as Maduro has, what they're willing to do?
I think sometimes when we have these conversations, they end up being so politicized or so political that we can ignore the very real human suffering that is happening. And it doesn't just happen on a monthly basis. It's happening daily. And when people are put into a situation where you don't have access to medicine, you don't have real access to food, you have people referring to starvation as the Maduro diet. These are things that I think in order to understand them, sometimes it really takes just being there and listening to somebody going through their story. You know, my whole worldview changed in a matter of meeting people who have shown me so much resilience. And it is astounding what people are capable of living through and so on.
Well, go ahead, Don. Yeah.
Well, I think this is a really vital point. And I think, you know, particularly when thinking about, you know, we've got five gringos sitting around a table here. We're not in Venezuela. That's clear. So what can we do here, right, to make Venezuelans' lives easier? And if this administration and its supporters in the United States actually cared about the plight of Venezuelans, who I think, as Noel actually really eloquently puts, the suffering that many people are facing, the hard decisions people are facing, leaving their country, leaving their home, then give Venezuelans in the United States TPP status. Give them protective status. Don't use them as political pawns. And that's precisely what they're doing, this administration is doing to Venezuelans today. I mean, another just thing to note, you know, the people who are making this very arduous journey are not affluent people. The Venezuelans that you encounter in the United States, in Canada, in Europe, you know, many of these people emigrated years ago, right? They're the more affluent professional classes, the people who had white-collar jobs in the state oil industry, right? These are people who had the means to leave. The people who are crossing the borders into Colombia and into Brazil are poor people. Right? They're people who formed the core constituency of Chavismo, but through years of the collapse of the oil economy, through increasingly crippling sanctions, through the kind of internal disintegration of the Bolivarian project, they're facing more and more dire situations. And so when you have this 10%, according to the United Nations, of the population that's fled in South America right now, what do you do for those people? And this is, again, this is where my concern as somebody located in the global north who has ties, you know, my in-laws are not Venezuelan, but I have, you know, friends and family. One doesn't work in a place for 10 years and not develop these sorts of affective ties. You know, what do you do for those people who are making these hard decisions? And what the Venezuelan opposition has done, people like Julio Borges, the leader of a political party named Primero Justicia, which started out its life as a United States-funded non-governmental organization, people like Antonio Ledezma, the former mayor of Caracas, Venezuelan opposition figures who are now living in Colombia or in Peru, what do they do for the Venezuelans who have crossed the border into Colombia, into Ecuador, into Peru, et cetera, et cetera? What do they do for these Venezuelans living in exile? They go on the air and they blame Venezuelans for the unrest that we saw in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Chile throughout the second half of last year, trying to build up more of that narrative that the Maduro government is essentially a destabilizing force throughout the region. They're playing politics with people's lives, right? And this is my concern, precisely because, you know, I'm a U.S. citizen who lives in Canada, which means I've got the double whammy in terms of North American governments trying to force regime change in South America right now. And so what we can do today is try to alleviate the suffering of the people, the Venezuelan people who have fled their country, and pressure our governments to stop pushing for more disastrous regime change.
We're going to return to that notion in just a moment here in terms of what's a sort of a viable menu of options then to show support. You want to add something, Vic?
Yeah. Yes. Along with that, it seems to me much of the disruption that's causing the refugee problem, anyhow, is from the United States. And it seems to me that maybe there should be a coalition led by the United States to help the refugees, the United States and other governments, and perhaps Venezuela itself could form a coalition to help the plight of these refugees.
Well, when it comes to evaluating the last 20-plus years, Don, those who are most sort of loudly and proudly supporting Guaido, everyone from different administrations, including the Trump administration, to his backers in various quarters, they're more likely, though not uniformly, but more likely to say that what we have seen is evidence that the Bolivarian reforms were doomed to failure anyway, that they did not yield successful and sustainable fruit, and that going back in that direction would be a disaster for Venezuela or for any nation that seeks sort of socialistic reforms at any level. Is that a good faith argument?
No, it's a garbage argument, I think would be the technical term. The reforms that took place during the Chavez years in Venezuela, so, you know, the early stage of kind of nationalistic, you know, trying to shore up the oil industry from 1999 to 2003 or so, after the second nationalization of oil that takes place after the failed coup of 2002 and then the failed oil coup of 2002 and 2003. Plug for this evening. We'll go into this in more detail later tonight at the Rockla event. The reforms that were carried out in the various stages of the Bolivarian process have always been tied to international markets and oil. They've always been, so their socialist reforms, quote unquote, the way I often put it for students is they're socialist-ish, is that, you know, what you have is a reinvestment in a social welfare net. You have a reinvestment in housing, in healthcare, in education, in access to three square meals a day, to food security. These are all reforms that don't necessarily entail socialism in anywhere in the world other than in the United States, frankly. These reforms made real gains in terms of cutting back on inequality, in terms of eradicating illiteracy, reducing extreme poverty and poverty rates, getting people access to education and upward mobility for the first time in generations, getting people access to basic medical care for first times in generations. They were very real reforms that cannot be discounted. And in fact, prior to the most recent period of unrest and polarization in Venezuela, I'm talking about the period characterized by when the opposition was led by Enrique Capriles Radonsky, the former governor of Miranda State, right? The man who ran against Hugo Chavez in 2012 and 2013, in 2013 ran against Maduro after Chavez died. Capriles even acknowledged that the social reform programs, the so-called Bolivarian missions in Venezuela that addressed these human welfare needs, were profoundly successful. He argued that, or he acknowledged that they were successful. He wouldn't say profound, right? He acknowledged that they were successful. He proposed to carry many of them forward, but tried to organize them on a basis that would look more like Lula's Brazil, right? That would be much more social democratic in nature, much less heated rhetoric towards the United States, much less heated rhetoric about socialism and anti-imperialism and all of this nonsense, right? He said, but we need these social programs because the economic reforms of the 1980s and 1990s were so disastrous. So my point here is that the crises in Venezuela today are not traceable to the early 2000s. In fact, they're traceable to the early 20th century that have to do with the oil industry. If anything, the early 2000s were a period in which the government, using the oil industry, attempted to alleviate a whole flotilla of inherited social harms that have been carried out as a result of economic restructuring in the late 20th century.
So let me read a little bit from an interesting set of ideas from NACLA, the North American Congress in Latin America, which I don't know, Don, if you have any thoughts on NACLA before I read some of their prescription.
this sounds like a – no, I've published with NACLA. I think they do good work.
Okay. So and they're, by the way, they're a nonprofit founded in 1966 with a mission of providing information on trends in Latin America and relations between Latin America and the United States. And they wrote recently, how should we respond to the
– Can I interrupt?
Yeah, please.
Sorry, is that an editorial you're quoting, or are you quoting an individual author who published with NACLA?
It's an editorial from NACLA. Yeah.
Thank you.
How should we respond to the fraught situation in Venezuela? The question has sparked heated debate on the left, both in the U.S. and around the world. And in the intensification of U.S. efforts to remove Maduro has lent the question renewed urgency. In our thinking, the mission should be guided by three principles: non-interventionism, self-determination, solidarity with the oppressed. And let me read a little bit about their sort of diagnosis of how this happened. They write the following. Venezuela has been governed for the past 20 years by the socialist PSUV party. From 1999 to his death in 2013, Hugo Chavez was president. He was succeeded by his right-hand man, Nicolas Maduro. And during its 2 decades in power, the PSUV gained control of many key institutions, including much of the judiciary, the Electoral Council, and the Supreme Court. And there were many gains made. Solidarity with the oppressed means acknowledging all aspects of what has gone wrong in Venezuela. And I'll read from them now here. Solidarity with the oppressed demands a correct analysis of causes of the crisis. The primary driver now is the government's mismanagement of its oil revenue through a disastrous currency policy and a failure to curb corruption on the order of hundreds of billions of dollars, even according to former Chavez officials. U.S. policy has exacerbated the crisis, particularly in the last 18 months. Sanctions implemented in August 2017 have triggered a major fall in oil production and oil revenue. The oil sanctions the Trump administration just enacted will have even more devastating consequences. Instead of playing an either-or game, both sources of Venezuela's crisis must be acknowledged. The government's criminal mismanagement, which cannot be dismissed as just errors, since systematic corruption exists at very high levels, and the U.S.'s brutal policy of deliberately increasing suffering as a way of pushing the population to turn against their own government. Don, do you agree that acknowledging both, do you agree that corruption in Venezuelan government has been at least as major a driver as U.S. foreign policy?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. The this is in many ways a made in Venezuela crisis.
Okay.
But U.S. policy has made it worse, not better, at every critical juncture.
Sure.
Maduro talks about how he's facing an economic war. He's facing sabotage from disloyal sectors of the import-export sector, of local business, and even of people in the national oil industry. He talks about how he's facing sanctions, how he's facing corruption. He calls this an economic war, and he's absolutely correct. All of that is happening. He has also, at every step imaginable, made bad decisions. He has made systematic errors that have been so consistent bad that they are nothing short of corruption. Yeah, of course.
Okay. And when it comes to that corruption, again, the critics of the Bolivarian mission will say, this just shows you how corruptible such a system is, that even the best intention of social welfare reforms ends up corrupted. And here we are, predictably, with the crisis. What do you think, Don?
Well, I think that would be the correct analysis if Venezuelan history began in 1998. The fact of the matter is that there's much by way of inherited corruption, of mismanagement, of a culture of, for example, the state oil industry being considered a state within a state, and so much money floating around because of the oil industry, that corruption was, for many, a permissible cause of doing business. That's the political culture of Venezuela prior to Chavez. Right. So corruption continues. It gets deeper in the context of the oil boom of the first decade of the century, when there's so much money that losing $1 billion here or there is seen as an accounting error for some of these people. It's unconscionable. Right. So corruption is absolutely a problem. It's a scourge that affects both the government and the opposition, but has deep roots that go back a century in Venezuela.
Noel, what do you make of NECLA's diagnoses, looking at, yes, U.S. foreign policy, but also not using that as just a sort of the scapegoat and sort of absolving Venezuelan corruption?
I think it's a more balanced perspective that I've seen. I mean, there is a very real and identifiable amount of kleptocracy in Venezuela. There is a very real concern for narco trafficking amongst ministers, which can be identified as well. And I think that I don't know how going forward. I know I spoke with Don before the show a few weeks ago, and you had mentioned free elections. Mm-hmm. Like, what if we could have free elections? And to me, I think, what are the elements that you would need to have in place, the conditions that you would need to have in place in order to have free elections?
That's and a fair if question. There, yeah.
I mean, if I could just list them, I mean, I think if you have like stable security, that would be something that you would need. You would need to be able to have some sort of oversight of possible corruption of potentially rigged elections. You would need to do something for the millions upon millions of Venezuelans who have left Venezuela. How would they be able to have a say in what happens to their country, you know, if they can't place a vote? You know, I'm not an expert in this, but I think if there is the dream to have free elections, but there is no real climate for it, I don't really know what we would be doing talking about it if that's it, if it's just a pipe dream.
Okay. Don, if I could, I'd like to get your sort of take on NACLA's view of the 2018 elections, which have been heavily debated. NACLA writes, many leftists argue that Maduro deserves support because he was democratically elected. According to this view, the principle of self-determination, at least in its minimal representative democratic variant, is still in effect in Venezuela. Defending Maduro is therefore the same as defending self-determination in Venezuela. But Maduro was not democratically elected. It is true, as leftists who support Venezuela's government note, that Maduro was declared the winner of the country's May 2018 presidential election. But all of this leaves out the crucial fact that Maduro banned Venezuela's leading opposition parties and candidates, most prominently Radonsky, from running. Leftists would rightly denounce a right-wing ruling party that engaged in such tactics themselves. And we must criticize Maduro for doing so as well. On top of that, Maduro's actions are part of a pattern since early 2016 of increasing authoritarianism. Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There've been a series of unqualifiedly, yes. The fact of the matter is that a lot of people would actually look at a number of the measures taken against prominent figures in Venezuela's opposition, people like Leopoldo López, people like Radonsky, like Capriles, and argue that, when López, for example, was placed under house arrest, first in prison and then under house arrest, that these were justifiable actions by people who have worked openly and publicly to sponsor violence. They have worked openly and publicly to encourage foreign intervention, that these are the sorts of behaviors that no sovereign state would tolerate. I mean, the U.S. doesn't let black people march to say that they shouldn't be shot, right? So there's an issue here of, you know, what's justified and then what's politically salient or what's tactically a good idea. Disallowing people like Capriles from running in the election, I think, was a tactical error and an anti-democratic measure. Guilty as he may be, sure, that's absolutely the case, that was an authoritarian move that really betrayed the degree to which, if nothing else, the government was not confident in the sort of support it could expect from its core constituencies. I mean, Chavismo, as you know, the movement is known, wins elections when lots of people turn out to vote. That's been the case. That's been the trend line since the early 2000s. Chavismo loses when you have massive absenteeism. And Maduro has never been as popular in the polls as Chavez was. He doesn't have the charisma. He doesn't have the organic ties to any of the social bases of the Bolivarian movement. And so he does not trust the electorate, which is why he relies disproportionately on the military for his power.
And so as Noel I think, understandably points out, there might be desperation among a Venezuelan public that is watching the world sort of say, Guaido or Maduro, and Venezuelans might be thinking, neither is good for us, but how do we create the conditions stable enough for true self-determination?
I think there was a moment early last year where a number of people in the Venezuelan expatriate community that I would speak to in Canada, in Toronto, which has a growing number of Venezuelans, as well as Venezuelan friends, you know, on WhatsApp or Twitter, who recognized that Guaido was a complete political non-entity prior to being basically deputized by Leopoldo López to declare himself president, right? And sanctioned by the Lima Group to do the same, and given the green light by the White House. And this all happened in the weeks leading to that January 23rd self-proclamation of his presidency. So people are the largest bloc, voting bloc in Venezuela, or political identified bloc for at least the last 10 years in Venezuela, has been that ni-ni bloc, the neither nor. But as to your question of how do you produce the conditions for something different, is you need some fresh blood. You've got a monopolization on power, both in the opposition. You know, Guaido is rightfully seen, I think, as a puppet now of Trump, but also of Leopoldo López previously. But there was excitement around him because he was new, because he was a non-entity. People within the government camp, like Héctor Rodríguez, who's a younger, former student Chavista leader, but strong ties to the social movements. He's the sort of new generation of leadership that people are looking to on the government side to kind of push beyond what we this kind of ossified, state and military dyad that's controlling the Venezuelan government at present. So what needs to happen is for a new leadership to emerge. And we've seen this elsewhere in the world where you think that there's the so-called perfect dictatorship of the PRI government in Mexico throughout the 20th century, where different generations of leadership actually regenerated the base of that party throughout its 80 years in power. Same can be said for the Cuban Revolution. The point here is that I think especially audiences in North America would be better served by not looking for a black and white solution to a problem that is labyrinthine in its reality and gray in its moral territory. That we're not going to get the elections that we might want tomorrow that are going to hand in, or going to bring to power a new sort of messianic figure in Venezuela. That this is a generational issue, that it's been a generational conflict that brought Chavez to power in the first place, and it's going to be a generational process of rebuilding Venezuela. But that's going to come from Venezuela. It's not going to come from Washington. It's not going to come from Miami. It's not going to come from Bogota.
So what does the next give me sort of a best case scenario that's a realistic set of possibilities in the next 12 to 24 months in Venezuela?
Everything depends on the election in the United States. To be perfectly honest, I mean, this is a rather dire sort of way to look at it, especially considering the way the Democrats are doing everything in their power to get Trump reelected. But right now, the normal calculus one would have is that it suits Trump best to have the kind of tense status quo, holding Venezuela up as a prop of, socialism is bad. It also curries a lot of votes in South Florida, which will be an important swing state. So for the foreseeable future, it looks like what's happening now will continue to happen. Tension, sanctions that are making difficult daily life that's already difficult, even more difficult for Venezuelans. Two kind of postscripts to that, though. The first being that the whole kind of spectacle that happened last month when Maduro prevented Guaido and his allies from attending National Assembly elections in Caracas, right? Arguably, the only reason Maduro did that was because the United States had just initiated a war of choice with Iran through the assassination of Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad, right? And that this was seen as an opportunity for Maduro to kind of flush out divisions within the opposition by giving Guaido, who'd been running out of steam for quite some time, the spotlight again. And indeed, I think that's what we're seeing in Venezuela right now, right? The sort of the perennial divisions within the opposition really percolating again as they divide and divide again and divide again. Meanwhile, Guaido is trying to say, well, I'm the one with the backing of Washington. So the situation in the United States in which Trump favors continuing the status quo might embolden Maduro to take steps to further weaken the opposition. The other postscript is directly related to the first, which is that Trump might, on a lark, send SEAL Team 6 to Caracas, because we just don't know with this guy. And that's a very real reality. That's a very real concern for especially the Venezuelan military, which would suggest a deepening of the kind of security and surveillance measures that we've been seeing ramping up throughout the current cycle of polarization in Venezuela. That's certainly been intensifying since 2014 at the earliest.
Vic, you want to add that?
Yes, I think the Trump's unpredictability, as we were just saying, is a large part of the reason that people fear him. And people need to take that into account. But further and more importantly, I think we need to talk more strongly about changing the position of the United States vis-a-vis Latin America. We have a history going back to 1954, at least, when we have worked, our government, that is, has worked to overthrow and modify countries in Latin America. There are about 12 countries in Latin America where this has happened, and the similarity here goes between especially the situation that occurred in Chile in 1975, when Kissinger and others here saw that the way to get control over the government, which they did not like since it was a freely elected government by Allende, the way to do it, as Kissinger said, was make the economy scream. And that's what Trump and others have been trying to do here in Latin America and now in Venezuela. Make the economy scream, and then enough people will become unhappy and angry that we can manipulate an overthrow.
I am late for our only break of the hour, and I want to come back to listener feedback. Some email and some phone calls to get through. So if you've sent some comments, we're going to get to that in just a moment. You just heard Vic Vinke, who's here from ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America. He's a member of their steering committee, and they have brought Donald Kingsbury to town for an event tonight. Don's a lecturer in political science and Latin American studies, and interim director of the Monk One program at the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. And also with us in studio is Noel Evans, who's a reporter and producer for WXXI News. That short break and some of your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, a conversation about the Equal Rights Amendment. And then in our second hour, a conversation about a piece you might have heard about in the New York Post recently about co-sleeping. It is a controversial article because pediatricians, experts who've studied the issue, have very different opinions than what the article that went viral expressed. And we're going to talk co-sleeping in our second hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get Herman in Brighton first on the phone. Go ahead, Herman.
Hello. I agree with a lot of what is being said, but I do want to make a clarification that I think didn't come through. It sounded almost like Maduro and Guaido are two equally unpalatable choices. But the very important difference is that Maduro is ensconced in power by, as you mentioned earlier, a not democratic election, and with the support, like most autocrats, with the support of the military. And as long as he is in power, there will not be free and fair elections, and the crisis and the suffering will go on. The difference with Guaido is he was democratically elected to his position as Speaker of the Legislature, which makes him next in line for the presidency if the presidency should come open. I don't think that was mentioned in today's discussion. And he declared himself interim president. This is not a coup. This is a transitional means to get to free and fair elections. And I would have high hopes that if Maduro leaves and Guaido becomes interim president, that there's at least a chance, or I would say a good chance, of there being free and fair elections, and that would be the first step towards relieving the horrible suffering, and then I would would think that all the sanctions would go away. And I don't see any other way that the Venezuelans on their own can bring about change as long as there's an oppressive regime supported by the military in power. So I just wanted to clarify that there's a huge difference, and that doesn't mean Guaido is an angel, and I'm not happy with to hear that he has made some unwise and unpalatable choices, probably out of pragmatism to ingratiate himself with the current American government. But I still think that that is the quickest way to get relief for the Venezuelan people, is to have this transition followed by a free and fair election.
All right, Herman, thank you very much. Don, what do you think?
Just to clarify, Guaido's self-proclamation actually does not follow the line of presidential succession according to the Venezuelan constitution. It comes through a loophole he cited in the constitution, a constitution, by the way, which his party and the Venezuelan opposition more generally has not recognized in 20 years, unless it's convenient for them. But according to the letter of the Constitution, if he was interim president, he should have called for elections within 3 months. And I'll take Herman's point in good faith that how can you do that if he's not actually in the presidential palace and doesn't control the electoral branch of government? More to the point, though, I think, is that Guaido has actually done rather little to organize the Venezuelan diaspora. He's done rather little to hold elections, to organize the people who are living in the United States, in Canada, and throughout South America, except for these kind of press junket or spectacles at the Colombian-Venezuelan border that are all meant to kind of strengthen his band and curry favor with the United States and with people who are arguing for what they're calling a humanitarian intervention. And that, I think, is the deeper problem, because again, the solution is not going to come from a simple change of the head of state. It can only come from a movement from below. And neither Maduro nor Guaido, with their respective constituencies, are attempting to do so.
Noel?
I want to point out how difficult it can be to mobilize people when their concerns are regarding food and medicine and basic needs and security. The other issue, appreciate what Herman brought up, is, I mean, a lot of people saw, I mean, Venezuelans that I spoke to said that the National Assembly was seen as the last pillar of democracy, which when it became divided, when the opposition and Guaido were not allowed to enter because the National Guard prevented entry. And instead, they had to go to the offices of the newspaper, El Nacional, if I remember correctly, in order to hold a vote. That was considered a major blow to, this quote-unquote last pillar of democracy. And the other issue, I mean, speaking of that newspaper, is there is a real concern about press freedoms in Venezuela. When the Venezuelan state has control over the narrative, you don't see as much about the humanitarian crisis. And there was a spike starting in 2016, from what I saw, regarding attacks on journalists as well. And actually, while BBC correspondent Guillermo Olmo was covering the National Assembly, the issue that was unfolding a few weeks back, a journalist was attacked and said that he was attacked by Chavistas. So there, you can't have a democracy without a free press, is what I would say.
Done.
Yeah, I think the issue of press freedom is really quite striking, and it's one that's often brought up in the context of Venezuela. What's often not brought up by the press when talking about press freedom in Venezuela is the historically politicized role of the press in Venezuela, particularly of the private media, who was an active participant, for example, in the 2002 failed coup against Chavez, that there has been, from the very beginning, a very politicized and antagonistic relationship between the government and the opposition media. And that I think, is the key here that gets left out of discussions around press freedom in Venezuela, is that the media has been aligned with the opposition throughout the last 20 years. They've not played the kind of, and I realize I'm in a building full of reporters, and so I need to be careful here, but the press has not been free and impartial in Venezuela. Especially not the private press. Now, does this forgive the attacks on reporters? Absolutely not. But it is an important context to keep in mind.
We can leave it there. Let me take a phone call from Gabrielle in Rochester. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah. So I was born and raised in Venezuela, and so there's a few issues that I kind of spotted as I try to have conversations about Venezuela. One of them is the oversimplification of the problems and what's happening. And, you know, a lot of people want to see these issues on that left and right political spectrum. And truly, the issues go much, much farther than that. And I've also noticed what I've identified as, I guess, arrogance and some of like that American arrogance, in that we want to blame fully the United States, whatever administration was in power about the issues that have happened in Venezuela. And on top of that, you add some of this like selective historical memory. And I can tell you that I lived my whole life through the consequences of Chavez's and Maduro's administrations. And as it's been brought up, there was deep, deep corruption in both administrations. So that's something, you know, I think it's fair to point out. And also, I feel like there's some disregard about the will of the Venezuelan people. So when you see someone like Guaido, and I see a lot of the term self-proclaimed president thrown around, and for many Venezuelans, like Noel mentioned, a lot of Venezuelans were excited when the National Assembly was voted in with what seemed to be pluralism and not just one party ruling. And there's lawmakers in there that have supported Guaido. So the issue and the problems go beyond Guaido, and it's to the point of oversimplification. You can just say that the opposition, anyone that's an opposition leader in Venezuela, is a puppet of Trump, because there's other countries, and there's over 50 countries that have recognized him as an opposition leader. It's concerning to see some of that oversimplification and painting this picture of Chavez's administration and quote-unquote socialism as something that was extremely successful, when my life was, very different than that. I lived, and by no means did I come from wealth. So, I lived through those projects and through those things. So I think the issues are much more complicated.
Okay, Gabrielle, thank you. Don, you want to respond? Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Your points are well to consider, Gabrielle. Is Gabrielle still on the line?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gabrielle, can I ask... You don't how to put this, I'm not trying to out your age or anything, but you talked about your entire lifetime and you talked about the Chavez and Maduro administrations. Did you experience much of the Punto Fijo years of the Fourth Republic?
I was too young.
Okay.
I was very little when Chavez was in power. So
I think there's a very real generational divide that's just a political reality that any government or any in any country really has to face, that you've got a generation of people who lived through the difficulty of structural adjustment, who lived through the government crackdowns and massacres of the Caracaso in 1989, when people rebelled against neoliberal economic reforms and were gunned down in the street by a democratically elected government of Carlos Andrés Pérez. This is before Chavez, right? Massacres that killed thousands of people over the course of a long weekend in 1989, right? You have a historical memory for people of an older generation of what life was like before Chavez, of a poverty rate that was over 50%. Right. Chavez comes to office, uses the oil industry to boost government revenues and boost government spending. And you see you see corruption as well, which is an endemic feature of Venezuelan politics. And it comes hand in glove with the oil industry, which I agree with you full wholeheartedly that the oversimplification to think this is a matter of Maduro versus Guaido misses the deep-rooted problems in Venezuela that arguably go back to the early 20th century. And again, that's Venezuela's a petrostate.
I think in our last minute here or so, Don, Gabriel's phone call, and I wish I had an hour just to sit down and understand his experience. His concern that if we could somehow have free and fair elections, but kind of move back towards Bolivarian missions, with maybe without that consistent feature of corruption, that things would be better off. I mean, that's a simplified question, but do you feel that that's the direction that would be ideal for Venezuela?
Absolutely. I mean, that would be ideal, but that is another oversimplification. Yeah. Unfortunately, increased public, and by public, I don't just mean elected and party official oversight. I mean actual public oversight, mm-hmm. of national industries like oil, like aluminum, like mining in the Amazon. Right. These are the sorts of things that you need to have a functioning economy that operates for the people. And that's what we would need as a precondition for rebuilding Venezuela in the aftermath of the current crises.
20 seconds. You've done such a good job of helping us stay grounded in the fact that when we speak something that feels far removed, there's real humanitarian crisis and human suffering. Some final thoughts from you.
I think that it's important to remember that there have been mass protests. There have been curfews. There has been state violence against protesters, and that is in recent memory. And while it is important to remember what had happened in the 80s, it's also important to remember what happened 2, 3, 4 years ago and even continues to today.
Thanks for being here, Noelle Evans, who is a reporter and producer with WXXI, and Don Kingsbury from the University of Toronto is in Rochester as a guest of ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America. Vic Vinke, tonight, 7 p.m.?
That's correct.
7 p.m. where?
Downtown Presbyterian Church.
Downtown Presbyterian Church, open to the public.
Open to the public and handicap accessible with parking across the street.
They'd love to see you there. Thanks for being here,
Vic.
Don, thanks for taking the time to come with us here.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate that. Our thanks to the entire team at Connections today, and that includes Emery Stein, who is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. And Don is our volunteer today. Thanks, Don. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.